Folks, thanks for coming along tonight to hear Troy Bramson, who makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the publication of his book, Bob Hawke, Demons and Destiny, the Definitive Biography, which has recently been published. And we've got copies for sale today and others for sale online for those who are on our Zoom call or who are watching this in other means later on. So Troy Bramson is well known to everyone here, so I'll introduce him very briefly. He's a senior writer and columnist at the Australian newspaper, previously a columnist with the Sunday Telegraph, and the author of 11 books. And the most recent book is this book on Bob Hawke. And so Troy is going to speak for us tonight on the topic of the same topic as his book, Bob Hawke's Demons and Destiny, for about half an hour. Then we'll go to questions and discussion. Troy, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, it is great to be back at the Sydney Institute, so thank you all for coming. And of course, I've had the pleasure of addressing this institute many times. And thank you also to Jared and to Anne for inviting me back, and also for the very valuable role that I think you play in promoting debate and discussion in this great city. Now, I first met Bob Hawke in 1994 when I was just 18 years old and in my first year at university. At a dinner, I approached Hawke, and as he shook my hand, he looked deep into my eyes and he asked my name. The room seemed to blur and the sound dulled. It was like being struck by lightning. I realised what so many others had experienced. He was charisma personified. I later learnt that much of Hawke's success on television in the 1960s, 70s and 80s was because he imagined talking to just one person. I once told him that when I was in primary school in the 1980s, that we had to do a school project on a famous Australian. Half the class chose Bob Hawke, the other half chose Paul Hogan. I later confessed to Bob that I chose Paul Hogan. He thought that was hilarious. Look, I was intrigued, fascinated, very interested in Bob Hawke as a man and as a political and trade union leader. I studied his life, I wrote about it, and I got to know him as a journalist and as a historian. I interviewed Hawke about 20 times over 15 or so years, including for this biography. And it was a real privilege to be the last person to interview Bob Hawke before his death 3 years ago this month. Hawke supported this book by also giving me access to his vast archive of personal papers, but it is an unauthorised biography and Hawke asked for no control over the manuscript. Bob Hawke, Demons and Destiny tells the story of an extraordinary life from border town to the lodge and beyond. The book is about the real Hawke, the complete man, chronicling the stunning triumphs and terrible lows, a life riddled with huge flaws but also great virtues, marked by redemption and reinvention, which changed Australia and shaped the world. There are new insights in the book drawn from newly discovered archival documents and interviews about his upbringing, childhood, school and university education, his deep love for Hazel, their often stormy marriage and family life, his career in the trade union movement and rise to become the greatest ever champion of Australian workers, his extraordinary prime ministership, which transformed Australia's economic, social, environmental and foreign policy settings, and his post-prime ministerial life, his devotion to Blanche Dalpuget, his business interests, his thoughts on modern politics and prime ministers. Bob Hawke was born in the small country town of Bordertown, South Australia, in 1929. Growing up the son of a clergyman and a school teacher, he was showered with parental love and told that he was special and that he was destined for greatness. Now, Hawke downplayed notions of divine intervention, but he did tell me that he felt there was some kind of guidance throughout his life. A turning point was a motorbike accident in 1947 while at university. Hawke nearly died, so he decided to make the most of his life. He was deeply religious as a young man, but his faith was shattered in 1952 during a Christian student conference in India. In India, he had witnessed widespread poverty, which shaped his belief and faith in the church. Hawke had first seriously thought about public service of some kind when he won a Rhodes Scholarship to commence in 1953. At Oxford University and later at the Australian National University, he was actually eyeing a career as an academic. He had earlier thought about becoming a farmer or a doctor. At Oxford, he wrote a thesis on the basic wage and the Australian industrial relations system. I think Oxford had a big impact on Hawke. It shaped his work ethic, his liberal values, his debating style, and how he related to others. In 1958, he was appointed the ACTU's research officer and advocate. He put his thesis into practical action, dazzling the industrial tribunals and courts with the force of his argument that wages should reflect productivity and prices. He won several critical cases, securing big pay rises for working men and women, and his star was ascendant. In 1969, Hawke won election as the ACTU's president. Over the next decade, he earned a reputation for resolving intractable industrial disputes. He led the union movement into several enterprises, and he became a prominent contributor to political debates. He was the most brilliant, most articulate, most effective leader the trade union movement had produced. Hawke had finally found an outlet for his talents. But the question of when he would go into politics percolated through the 1970s. The idea that Hawke could be Prime Minister one day excited some people and repulsed others. But it remained an idea so pregnant with promise that it was fixed in the public mind. The problem was that Hawke was a notorious drinker, infamous womaniser, and prone to angry public outbursts. His emotions, whether revealed as tears or temper, were often vividly on display. He was a terrible, loathsome, awful drunk, and could get verbally abusive when inebriated. He actually first drank alcohol while studying at the University of Western Australia in 1949, his third year at university. He later entered the Guinness Book of Records while at Oxford University for downing 2.5 pints of beer in 12 seconds. In the 1960s or 70s, Hawke might drink 20 beers in one evening session. He was also a serial adulterer. Some women threw themselves at him, mesmerised by his charisma and power. Others he flatly propositioned. When scorned, he would often lash out and humiliate them. He could be very selfish and very careless. He married Hazel Masterson in 1956, and they raised three children, Susan, Stephen, and Roslyn. They lived with the roiling turmoil that most Australians read about or saw on television, and they suffered because of it. Hawke personified the very best and very worst in Australians. He was a deeply flawed person, and his behaviour would not be tolerated today. Standards have changed. He could be vain and arrogant one moment, and then compassionate and inspiring the next. He embodied a mix of contradictions and contrasts, but he was an authentic political leader. He never hid who he was or tried to be someone that he was not. The book accordingly deals with Hawke's complex personality, the light and the shade, and the real man behind the legend. The demons are not ignored and they are not sanitised. They were a big part of Hawke's life. I believe it would have been a dereliction of my duty as a biographer if I did not explore these demons fully. Hawke gave up the booze and stabilised his emotions to become Prime Minister. But he still had a steady group of women who satisfied his sexual needs. He had affairs as Prime Minister, including at the lodge. Hawke did not believe, however, that he had an addictive personality. He refused to accept that he was an alcoholic and would never have accepted that he had an addiction to sex. In truth, he was both a highly functioning alcoholic and a sex addict. The World Health Organization has identified what they call compulsive sexual behavior disorder, and I argue that Hawke had it, and Blanche Dalpuget agreed with me. Hawke always lived a supercharged existence. In the 1960s and 70s especially, his celebrity status reached its zenith. as ACTU advocate and then ACTU president and Labor's national president, he engaged the public consciousness like no other political or union figure. He was at the epicenter of a great celebrity drama in which he was the dominant figure. The drinking, the womanising, emotional reactions, critical assessments, the audacious idea of consensus, the man with the ear of politicians and business titans, and the speculation about when he would go into politics. The long, wavy, metallic hair, the tanned, soft olive skin, the arched eyebrows, the mouth with the corners turned down, the darting eyes with cigar in hand became legendary. He carried himself with an air of satisfaction and he projected confidence. Television was his premier means for talking to everyday Australians. At a moment's notice, like a board being clacked on a soundstage, he could transform to suit the audience. He was a supreme performer who could turn on a range of emotions as though flicking through index cards until he found the right one. Charm, persuasion, indignation, anger, sadness, humour. Voters tuned in because they did not know which Hawke they would get. One of the most extraordinary interviews Hawke did in the 1970s was with female journalist Tony McRae for the Sun newspaper. Over a bottle of Veuve Clicquot at the Boulevard Hotel, he loosened his tie and kicked off his suede shoes and spoke about his family, his propensity to cry, his sleeping and eating habits, and he gave critical assessments of Gough Whitlam and Malcolm Fraser. He did one-arm push-ups while ruminating on the idea of being Prime Minister one day. "I'm not expecting that the Prime Minister should be offered to me on a platter," he said, switching arms, "but if it was offered to me on a platter, I'd do it bloody well." Now, Ros Kelly told me about Hawke campaigning with her in Canberra in 1980. It did not go to plan. While driving Hawke around in her car, they stopped at a set of traffic lights and looked across and saw two young women in a VW convertible with the hood down. The girls noticed Hawke and they shouted out, "Bob, come and join us." He quickly jumped out of the car and into the back of their VW and disappeared for 2 hours. He later joined Roz at a shopping centre as if nothing had happened. Hawke then asked the local chemist about the best shampoo for his hair. Australians accepted his faults because he was open about them. They witnessed him change in pursuit of his ambition. He did go off the drink and moderate his behaviour to demonstrate that he could be a disciplined Prime Minister. So by the time Hawke reached the Prime Ministership in 1983, he was the brightest star in the political galaxy. For decades, he had been a larrikin, intellectual celebrity superstar. Labor MPs likened Hawke to the Pope being on the campaign trail. People just wanted to touch him, they recalled. Women would thrust their children into his arms and steal a kiss for themselves, while men shook his hand and patted him on the back. Australians saw Hawke sing, dance, hold a bat, kick a football, throw a frisbee, shake hands with children and pat small animals. His central ambition was to unite and reconcile the nation after years of division and confrontation with the promise of consensus policy making. As Prime Minister, as he had done at the ACTU, he brought Australians together. In 1984, his approval rating reached an astonishing 78%. No Prime Minister has come within cooee of that decades before or decades after. His overarching vision for Australia was to have a more competitive and productive economy and a compassionate society at home, and to be an independent and respected nation abroad. He wanted to end the policy stagnation and transform Australia's economic, social, and environmental and foreign policy settings for a new age. Consider the social policy achievements: Medicare, the Sex Discrimination Act, increasing high school completion rates from about 35 to 77%, overhauling universities and trades education, doubling childcare places, targeting welfare to those most in need, and the world-class response to HIV/AIDS. The economic reforms we all know well: the floating of the dollar, the accord to moderate wages, dismantling the tariff wall, privatisation of government assets, national superannuation, and the first budget surpluses since the 1950s. Hawke wanted Australians to be proud of their nation and did much to cement our national identity and independence. With a new anthem, adopting the green and gold as the national colours, wattle as the floral emblem, and passing the Australia Act, which, among other things, ended appeals to the British Privy Council. And there are the landmark environmental achievements, saving the Daintree, Kakadu, and the Franklin River. We became more prosperous, better educated, more equal, more compassionate, entrepreneurial, optimistic, and proud of our nation. Hawke also played an important role on the world stage as a mediator between East and West. He developed close relations with Cold War leaders around the world, and he strengthened the US alliance and made engagement with Asia a priority. His personal diplomacy safeguarded Antarctica from mining. He led the fight against South African apartheid and initiated the APEC Trade Forum. I argue that this vast policy legacy, plus his personal popularity and four election victories in a row, is unmatched by any other prime minister or government post-war. Much of these achievements are due to the exceptionally talented group of ministers around the cabinet table, including Paul Keating as the dynamic treasurer. Hawke met the standard for how a prime minister should lead the nation, their government, and their party. Many of Hawke's parliamentary colleagues thought he would never be prime minister, let alone a highly disciplined one. But as president of the ACTU and as a member of the Reserve Bank Board, he had a good grounding in public administration. While the government traded on Hawke's popularity, he had to master the machinery of government to be effective. He understood the levers of power. Hawke was able to bend the machinery of government to implement Labor's policies while persuading his party's constituency to stick with the government, and was also able to win support from the other side of politics. He led a government of longevity, the longest of any federal Labor government. The model of governing that Hawke established is an underrated aspect of his legacy. The model, I think, has as its hallmarks a cabinet chairman of the board who worked cooperatively with ministers, welcomed frank and fearless advice from public servants and senior staff, put the national interest ahead of political self-interest, had a strong work ethic, focus and drive, and knew how to communicate persuasively with voters. These things are an underrated aspect of Hawke's legacy. They are the art of politics, but I think we can all recognise that it's been in short supply in recent years. Of course, Hawke was helped by having a very talented group of ministers. Paul Keating, as I say, was the innovative and persuasive treasurer. He described himself in an interview as the managing director to Hawke's chairman of the board. They were, for the most part, a great political duo. Liberal leader John Hewson said the Hawke cabinets were the best since Federation. Hawke was not an interventionist prime minister. He was consultative and collaborative, and he let his ministers run their portfolios. The array of talent sitting around the cabinet table, especially in the first two or three terms, was extraordinary. Paul Keating, Bill Hayden, Lionel Bowen, John Button, Don Grimes, Gareth Evans, Susan Ryan, Peter Walsh, Mick Young, Gordon Scholes, Kim Beazley, John Dawkins, Neil Blewett, Brian Howe, Michael Duffy, and Ralph Willis, among others. The first cabinet was extraordinarily diverse in their backgrounds, education, and work experiences. There were unionists like Hawke, Keating, Willis, Young, and Scholes, a shearer in Mick Young, a doctor in Don Grimes, a farmer in Peter Walsh, a policeman in Bill Hayden, lawyers Lionel Bowen and John Button, a school teacher in Susan Ryan, and an academic in Gareth Evans. Several already had ministerial experience, such as Keating, Hayden, and Bowen, or had served on the backbench in government, such as Willis, Scholes, Grimes, Walsh, and Young. In time, the ministry would include three Rhodes Scholars, Hawke, Beazley and Blewett. Bowen had served in World War II, Young had been Labor's National Secretary, and Scholes had been Speaker of the House of Representatives. Most had working class or middle class backgrounds. This diversity of backgrounds and experience, I think, has been lost in modern politics. Hawke often let cabinet debates run and allowed ministers to have a say, but would intervene on critical issues. Debates in Cabinet and those in the caucus and at party conferences were often very robust, but Hawke kept the government largely united. Hawke assembled a talented personal staff and worked cooperatively with the public service. He had learnt from the mistakes of the Whitlam government in administration and Cabinet and party management. He was wise, I think, to appoint senior public servants, Graeme Evans, Chris Conybeare, Sandy Holway and Dennis Richardson as his principal private secretaries. The personal style Hawke brought to the Prime Ministership was also critical. He was an effective communicator and a powerful persuader. He had a strong work ethic, energy and drive. While luck typically ran his way, such as facing a divided opposition, he also showed courage and took political and policy risks. He won the 1987 and 1990 elections after being well behind in the polls. While he was popular for most of his prime ministership, he had qualities that were more important than this: respect and trust. He was competent, safe, and reassuring. He put the nation before self-interest and partisanship. He saw political opponents as adversaries, not enemies, and he eschewed class warfare. English journalist Walter Badgett described a statesman as someone of common opinions and uncommon abilities, who most felicitously expresses the creed of the moment, who administers it, who embodies it in laws and institutions. Hawke made mistakes, like any Prime Minister, and he had regrets, not least the 1990 recession, which had a devastating impact on many Australians, and his failure to advance Indigenous land rights. But he nevertheless had Badgett's essential elements of a statesman. He also changed Labor by retuning its philosophy, transforming its governing culture, and making it electorally dominant. He made the party fit for purpose, winning elections and staying in power. He achieved his goal of leading a Labor government in power for more than just a few terms. He took Labor to four election victories and is the party's most successful leader. I think it's also important to note that Hawke managed his party through a period of profound change. He culled the party's sacred cows by accepting as a necessity market-based economic reforms while expanding a strong social safety net. He transcended the party and enlarged its beliefs, and he made it contemporarily relevant. While Hawke was personally flawed and acknowledged his failings as a husband and a father, he was a very effective Prime Minister who did bring people together, established a model for effective leadership, and remade Australia for the modern era. Now, this has been a mammoth project that involved turning over 1 million pages of archival documents here and overseas, reading 100,000 newspaper articles and hundreds of books. But I love spending time in archives because it's like stepping into a time machine and being transported to the past. The documents discovered for this book for the first time, I think, are significant. They include unpublished memoirs, diaries, letters, meeting records, briefing papers, and handwritten notes. For example, Clem Hawke's unpublished family memoir, Hawke's diary of his trip to India for that Christian student conference I mentioned, Hawke's diary of his journey to Oxford, where he witnessed the brutality of South African apartheid and predicted a day of reckoning would come. This was 1953. Letters between Bob and Hazel in the 1950s and 60s, which expose his struggle against his demons as he pours out his emotions. Diplomatic cables from the United States and United Kingdom from the 1970s, showing Hawke to be too frank with his views on politics. Secret letters that Hawke and Bill Hayden exchanged about the Labor leadership in 1983, sealing a deal which became the foundation for the Hawke government. Newly declassified ASIO documents, which expose Labor figures with Communist Party links, diaries and meeting records and letters with Cold War leaders such as Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Margaret Thatcher, John Major, Brian Mulroney, Mikhail Gorbachev, Hu Yaobang, Zhao Ziyang and Nelson Mandela. There's also Hawke's handwritten cabinet room notes, his briefs and his papers, Bill Hayden's letters to the Queen as Governor General, and notes made by both Hawke and Paul Keating about their leadership discussions, including a very different account of the 1988 succession deal made at Kirribilli House. It was also a great privilege to interview more than 100 people for this book. Hawke's family, his friends, his school and university classmates, union and party and ministerial colleagues, international contemporaries such as George H.W. Bush, John Major, Brian Mulroney, George Shultz and James Baker. I also interviewed all the prime ministers who succeeded Hawke, from Paul Keating to Scott Morrison, and include their very, very generous assessments of him in the book. And I also include Hawke's assessments of them, which are not as kind as they were about him. I always checked and double-checked things in the book. I remember ringing Robert Ray, the former defence minister, one day to fact-check something. Ray said, "I guess this is one of your challenges, working out who is telling the truth, a half-truth, or forgetting something altogether." And I asked, "But everything you've told me is 100% true, isn't it, Robert?" And he replied, tongue-in-cheek, "Well, 90% of it." I was also interested in a phone call that Gareth Evans had with James Baker, the US Secretary of State, at the start of the Gulf War. This was a pivotal conversation because Gareth Evans wanted maximum consultation in return for the commitment of Australian forces. James Baker told me, "Gareth wanted me to tell him exactly when the balloon was going up to start the war. He and I had a few words over that, but I enjoyed working with Gareth." Now, Evans had a very different recollection of that phone call. Evans remembered Baker saying, "Who's running this effing war? We appreciate your support, but we are running this war. We have the military leadership, and you guys will cooperate with everything that we do." Knowing how tough James Baker is, I think Evans's recall is probably more accurate. So in conclusion, I must say this book has been a big part of my life for many years. I have vivid memories of interviews with people like Graham Frudenberg, Susan Ryan, Bob Sorby, Andrew Peacock, George Shultz, and of course Bob Hawke, who are no longer with us. I think this book will be challenging for many people to read. It will shock and surprise some of those who think they already know and understand Hawke. Hawke did trust me to write a serious, well-researched and balanced account of his life, and I believe that I have. What should be front of mind as we remember Hawke is that he loved Australians and they loved him. I don't think we've had a post-war leader who was more popular, respected or trusted. And so this is what has motivated my three prime ministerial biographies: to understand their values, their motivations and ambitions, how they led, how they gained and used political power, and their legacy. As I write in the book, in Hawke, Australians saw the mysterious but always recognisable alchemy of political leadership. And that is what should be remembered above all. Thank you.
Thanks, Troy. So we come to questions and discussion. As I said earlier, copies of Troy Bramson, Bob Hawke, Demons and Destiny, the definitive biography, is on sale tonight and also online later on. And so we come to questions and discussion. Remember, those on Zoom can send in their questions and I'll transmit them to Troy. You've identified character flaws in Bob Hawke and you mentioned two policy disappointments, one about Aboriginal land rights and the other about the recession of 1990. But there were some policy problems with Hawke early on. I mean, as you know, Hawke and Keating were very critical of the Whitlam Labor government's economic performance. But Whitlam's people said that when Hawke was head of the ACTU, he was a large part of the problem, because you point out in your book that in 73 and 74, across some of these awards, wages were going up 74-78% annually. And you had an centralised industrial relations system. He was a leader of the industrial relations club, and Hawke would constantly say that there was no relationship at all between across the wage wage increases without reference to productivity. So did Whitlam and co have a serious criticism about Hawke that later on he lectured them about stuff that he didn't do when he was head of the ACTU?
Yeah, Jared, there's no doubt that Hawke and Whitlam did not get on during the period of the Whitlam government, and there's some very funny stories in the book about their interaction where they didn't see eye to eye. Hawke was not particularly cooperative, but I don't think Whitlam was particularly cooperative either. I think blame can probably be laid at both of their feet. There was a thing called the Australian Labor Advisory Council, which was made up of politicians, union figures, party figures, staff, and they tried to meet several times, and at one meeting early in the government, Gough Whitlam arrived about 2 hours late, and the rest of them were just so angry they left the meeting and thought this was terrible the way they were treated, and it never met again until the 12th of November 1975, the day after the dismissal. Look, there's a couple of industrial relations aspects to that question which I won't go into detail, but just simply say, yes, they should have had a more cooperative relationship like they established in the Hawke government with the accord process, with Bill Keelty as trade union leader. You know, the trade union movement was co-opted to be part of the big reform program, and the trade union movement made a lot of sacrifices in the 1980s. I guess one of the things that Hawke would say is that a number of the ministers gave significant pay increases to public servants during the Whitlam government, and then that led the private sector to make catch-up wage claims. And so you had this sort of spiralling effect where they weren't able to bring wages and prices together and they were out of kilter. So I think there's plenty of blame to go around there, but that is really one of the key lessons of the Whitlam government, which was improving that relationship with the trade union movement.
Just before we do, we'll just get a quick microphone in there. Just can you solve us, the big point about your book is you didn't, Philip Adams says you didn't interview him, and he could have told you about the punch-up he had with Hawke in an airport lounge. What's the scoop on that?
I know you're very interested in that. Unfortunately, I don't have anything to add to that. I'm a little bit sceptical about it, let's put it that way. But Hawke was known to have plenty of punch-ups in the 1960s and 1970s. But funny enough, he always usually had another political or trade union colleague who would quickly get in and stop any brawl breaking out. But whoever challenged Hawke always came off second best, even if Hawke never touched them, because he had so many friends and supporters. So look, I'm sceptical about that story.
Okay, there's a question here. Jonathan, is it you next door?
Yes.
Okay, just push it up.
I've got nothing profound to say, but just pass on a little anecdote. A friend of mine,
just speak up a bit.
A friend of mine played cricket with Bob Hawke in Canberra when he was in his 20s, and Hawke proposed a bet that he, Bob Hawke, would be Prime Minister by the time he was 50. My friend won the bet, but not by much.
Yeah. Look, that is interesting. It was interesting for me to go back and look at the family story, the family legend about Hawke, and this sort of sense of destiny that is there throughout his life. And, you know, it's funny because it's actually there in his father's unpublished memoir on the opening pages. I got access to this. I've been looking for it a long time, and one day it was at the bottom of a box in Bob Hawke's office. I thought it had disappeared. And there it was. As you turn the pages, the family legend is revealed. So as Bob Hawke comes blinking into the early morning light in Bordertown in 1929, the doctor turns to the nurse and says, "This is a very special boy." And the nurse says, "Yes, he is." And the parents agree. And so that was, you know, the beginning of the Hawke story. But he was destined for the prime ministership, his mother thought, his father agreed. But it took him a while, as I say, until he saw that himself and found his path.
Just stay here. Yes, Christian.
So you've talked about his flaws. One of the things that has interested me for many years, when the Harvey Weinstein story broke, The Australian ran a story, which was republished from the United States, about the silent enablers who had enabled people such as Weinstein to get away with it. And it crossed my mind that in Australia, in a sense, the Australian people had been the silent enablers. And I turned to his previous biography by his conflicted biographer, and she really skated over those things while referencing them. And so other than the Australian people as a whole, who were the silent enablers who enabled Hawke to do, you know, what he did, which was to greet people in his towel in his hotel room like the aforementioned Weinstein?
Well, Hawke did like to be naked. I'll just start with that. He liked to be naked all the time. He was naked in front of his staff. He was naked in front of cabinet ministers. And Bill Hayden had great relish telling me that he had heard so much about the size of Bob Hawke's important appendage that he was profoundly disappointed when he realised it was not as large as he had made out. But look, Bob Hawke is not Harvey Weinstein, okay? I'm not aware of any examples of particularly inappropriate relationships that Hawke had with women. There's a number of ways to unpack this. It's an important question. So I'm not aware of any assault, any rape allegation or anything like that. So let's just be clear about that. The thing to say about Bob is that a lot of women threw themselves at him, literally. I mean, he did have charisma, he did have power. When I interview people like Susan Ryan or Ann Summers or other women who remember Hawke in that period, they said that's what he was like. And they remember that very, very clearly. So he didn't have any trouble finding women who wanted to go to bed with him. The other point to make is standards have changed. I mean, media standards have changed. Journalists knew about this. I've interviewed journalists for the book and they didn't report it. Public standards have changed. People saw Hawke in public acting in this manner and didn't do anything about it. That wouldn't happen today, thankfully. And I do say, quite critically, that Hawke's behaviour was appalling, not only for some women, but also for his family. You know, Hazel went through an enormous amount. She had women ringing her at home, saying they had had sex with her husband, saying that she should leave her husband. You know, got letters in the mail. It was pretty awful. And they're the people, as I say, who suffered the most, the family. So there's a number of elements to that. The other quick point to make is that Bob Hawke was always a great advocate for advancing the status of women in society. He did it at the ACTU. He did it as Prime Minister. Susan Ryan said when she was pushing the Sex Discrimination Act, the most important minister around the table was Bob Hawke. Other ministers didn't want her to do that. So, you know, it's a complex story, but I don't spare Hawke in the book.
Can I just make, don't walk away, just come back.
Sorry.
Just on one point. Malcolm Fraser was severely criticised in the media for what happened to him in Memphis when he reported at the check-in during the night without his trousers. Now, at that time, when Fraser copped that criticism, which was very substantial in the media, Hawke was Prime Minister, and the media who commented on Fraser never said a thing about Hawke, and you're dealing here at the same time.
Yep.
Exactly the same time.
That's a very valid point, Jared. All I can say is that I was in primary school at the time. I wasn't a journalist. I would take it up with the press gallery at the time. I plead no guilt for not reporting
those
issues.
Some of them are still members of the press gallery.
Well, they are. Well, they are, in fact, and it reflects a different media culture. It's a media culture that also protected John F. Kennedy, who was far worse than Bob Hawke in terms of women and how he treated them, and many other people. And thankfully, our standards have changed and the media has changed.
Well, you've done two biographies. Three. Keating and Hawke,
and Menzies.
We'll just put Menzies aside. But with the demise of Hawke in 91, did they change their views, Hawke and Keating, retrospectively about those events, or did Hawke always say it as wrong and Keating always as right, even through the years of being able to look back?
Are we talking about the leadership change?
Yes, in 91.
Yeah, in terms of their legacies, look, throughout the 1990s and 2000s, they sparred frequently in the media. I wrote some of the stories where they disagreed with each other about who gets what credit for what policy item. That's really the extent of their disagreements in post-prime ministerial life. Keating, of course, was very frustrated that Hawke didn't hand over the prime ministership like he had promised to do in 1988 to take place in 1990, or after the 1990 election. So there were some strong disagreements there, and Keating holds some bitterness about how long he had to wait to get the job. But I would say this, is that they remained very respectful and admiring of each other right up until their death. In the book, I include the only account Keating's ever given about his final ever meeting with Hawke, which was at Hawke's house at the end of 2018. Very emotional for both men. As Hawke recalled it to me, he had tears in his eyes about how happy he was that Keating came to see him just before he died and they could recognise their relationship. But they both would disagree with the notion that it needed to be reconciled. There's no break. They just had sharp disagreements. I think it's kind of like a brotherly love for each other, bit of rivalry, bit of contempt, bit of admiration, a bit of all of these things. But they remained a great duo, and it is very touching and moving to recall their final meeting, that they could come together at the end.
Thanks, Troy. So he's a great reformist Prime Minister. Could you posit, could he get away with it now? Could he do it now? You know, with the political media conditions we have now, would he still be as successful?
It's a good question. It's an important question. I think there's no doubt politics is harder today than it was then. But having said that, Hawke, and I would put John Howard in this category and some other Prime Ministers as well, had a feel for politics, you know, the art of politics. It's hard to identify, but you know they've got it, an understanding of what the mainstream Australian wants and looks for. Good at running a cabinet. You know, these things sound easy. I spent some time in my presentation and in the book writing about how Hawke led a government, because it seems easy, you know, managing a group of people in cabinet, paying attention to the public service, having an effective staff, being able to articulate and implement policy. These things we take for granted. And I think the last, you know, five or six prime ministers, well, I'd say five prime ministers, haven't really been able to do that. And there's a talent that you need for running a government. So Hawke had it and Howard had it, but they would find politics tougher today because of the social media, because of 24-hour news, because I think of the tribal nature of aspects of our media. But they would find it harder. But I would like to think they could do better than the last five prime ministers we've had.
So we've got a question here from Zoom from Fred Chilton. Was Hawke essentially narcissistic, or can be explained in other ways?
It's a good question. I say he's not a narcissist. He would have elements of a narcissistic personality. He could be vain. He could be arrogant. He could be particularly proud. But he's not a narcissist, because a narcissist wouldn't believe in consensus policymaking, wouldn't be able to share power around the cabinet table, wouldn't let ministers do their own portfolios with little intervention. A narcissist wouldn't be interested in what a public servant said or a staff member said. And Hawke was very happy to be challenged on policies and political strategy. I mean, Graham Frydenberg told me that he, as Hawke's speechwriter, he would wince and shrink in his chair at how vehement and how tough his political advisers, Peter Barron and Bob Sorby, could be with Hawke if they disagreed with him. And Hawke always accepted that and bore no grudges, didn't get them removed from the office. So I don't think he is a narcissist. I think that the whole makeup of Hawke and the way he governed runs against that.
But Gail Appleton tells the story of him undressing and standing in front of the mirror. That's somewhat narcissistic.
Well, as I say, he had elements of a narcissistic personality, but other aspects of his personality run completely opposite to that. But Gail Appleton was an important interview in the book. She revealed for the first time her secret relationship with Hawke, and to give people an insight into what that world was like from his perspective. You know, the job of a biographer is to get close to the person and to try to put yourself in their eyes and in their orbit, what they understand, what they see. And so Gil talking for the first time about that relationship with Hawke is someone or something that I greatly respected.
I'm looking forward to the postmodernist feminist deconstruction of all the male versions of how Hawke got away with it, because I think he was nowhere near as just a boy playing around. I think he would have offended most of us nowadays if we knew exactly what went on between him and a lot of the women. There are open accounts of him pushing women up against a wall, and he was a very boisterous and not a very nice person. But that aside, he was successful, although I think there's been a lot of romancing about the Hawke-Keating period, because like Jared and you, I lived through it, and interest rates were so high that they make interest rate rises now look farcical. Life wasn't as easy financially as we all look back and think. They did take a lot of steps to reform the economy that weren't done under Fraser. But in the end, it all ended in tears. And I remember 1996 being a huge landslide for John Howard, who wasn't popular and wasn't really a big name necessarily. So what went wrong? Because it wasn't all positive.
No, it's not all positive. The book's not a hagiography. I'm very tough on Hawke across the board, not only in his personal life, but also on some policy missed opportunities and some policy failures. The recession is a really important one, and I write about that in detail. After the stock market crash in 1987 or fall, the public service expected there to be a 1930s style recession. That didn't happen. The economy remained buoyant, and the Reserve Bank, funny enough we say this today, waited too long to put up interest rates to cool the economy, and then waited too long to bring them down again on the other side. So the government was still grappling with understanding the new deregulated economy that they had created, and they made some significant mistakes there. I think it's interesting to note, though, that official interest rates were still higher under the Fraser and Whitlam government, but nevertheless, interest rates were high and were damaging for that government. As for 1996, of course, Keating was Prime Minister then. No government since their government has won five terms, not even John Howard's government. Governments have an end-of-life span. I'm not sure that they could have won a sixth election victory in a row. There's only been one other government to do that, and that's the Menzies government. So, you know, it was pretty tough in to think that in 1996 Keating could do that, but that's another Prime Minister, and he made many mistakes which contributed to the size of that defeat, which I wrote about in my Keating biography.
Just looking around here, let me know if you want to come in to the discussion. So tell us about 1991, because Hawke's won four elections. He's popular. The opposition is still divided. So why did that come about? There were two election ballots. So take us through what happened there and how Keating got up in the end.
Look, it's a fascinating story. Of course, Hawke and Keating had done the deal in November 1988 at Kirribilli House for Hawke to hand over the leadership, the prime ministership, to Keating after the 1990 election. Hawke wanted to keep Keating on as treasurer. He was worried Keating would quit if he didn't get a guarantee about the job. So he got Keating to go again for another election in 1990 and then gave himself another couple of years in office. So it's a pretty sweet deal for Hawke. And Keating has come to the view, like me, that Hawke was never going to honour that deal. He should have honoured that deal. All of Hawke's senior supporters I interviewed for the book, Robert Ray, Gareth Evans, Kim Beazley, a whole host of them, all believe that Hawke should have handed over to Keating as he said he would. There was a kind of a pause in hostilities with the Gulf War at the end of 1990 going into 1991. And Keating thought that Hawke would never give up the job because he was loved being a wartime prime minister, as he saw it. Keating described Hawke as like Napoleon without the hat. And so this feud was going to explode. I mean, it was going to explode. It was always going to happen. And it happened in 1991. The government essentially threw away that year, even though there were some still significant policy decisions made. And it took Keating two goes to blast Hawke out of office. And in the end, Hawke's popularity had declined quite a bit by mid-1991. John Hewson was preferred prime minister. The coalition was well ahead in the polls. You know, John Hewson would be introduced on radio as the next prime minister. It was so obvious, it was so clear to the media that Hewson was going to win the next election that the caucus came to the view that Hawke couldn't win the next election. At least Keating would give them a shot. But it was a narrow result. 56 to 51 was the result. So a change of three people in that caucus would have seen Hawke win that second ballot, remain as Prime Minister. I spent a lot of time analysing the numbers, and I worked out that Hawke had three votes, maybe four, that he could have got that he didn't get. He didn't ring Wendy Fayton, who had voted for him in June. He didn't ring Peter Baldwin, who had voted for him in June. They voted for Keating. And Hawke lost a critical number, which has not been revealed before, and that was John Kerrin. He's close cabinet supporter. Kerrin voted for Hawke in June, but secretly voted for Keating in December. So look, the time was up. The thing is, though, that Keating won that 1993 election. So Hawke had bad judgment because Hawke said that only he could win that election. He was wrong about that, but he was in good company because John Gorton, Malcolm Fraser and Gough Whitlam also said that Keating would lose that election, but he didn't.
Certainly most of the press corps, I think.
That's true, that's true.
Tell me, in the 1980s, how much was the Hawke government helped by what the coalition did? In 85, the change from Peacock to Howard, then in 87, Joe for Canberra, in 89, back from Peacock, back from Howard. How much did that help the Hawke government as opposed to just the Hawke government's abilities?
Yeah, look, I mean, it was helpful, and I say, you know, that luck often ran Hawke's way. I mean, just as Robert Menzies was helped by facing Bert Everett and Arthur Corwell, Hawke benefited by facing Andrew Peacock and John Howard, although they're more substantial figures than Corwell and Everett. Look, the opposition leaders made critical mistakes. They were divided. Hawke was able to exploit those and keep winning re-election. It was pretty close, though, in 1990. You know, Andrew Peacock led the coalition to more than 50% of the two-party vote, and he nearly won. The other thing to say about the opposition in the period is that you know, there's been this sort of claim that the opposition supported the key economic reforms of that period, and I've interviewed John Howard, and he's made that argument to me. In fact, they didn't support things like the Accord, and you know, there were other elements of that. They didn't support the big social policy reforms, whether it's Medicare or things like that. And even if you go back and look at the float of the dollar, the Country Party led by Doug Anthony didn't support the float of the dollar. And Andrew Peacock didn't support the float of the dollar. He was the Liberal leader. John Howard did, but he's the only one I could find on the record in 1983 supporting the float of the dollar. So there's been a little bit of revisionism about that. And when I asked Hawke about how important the coalition support were for some reforms, he just dismissed it and said, I didn't need their support. We were going to do it anyway, and we had the support of the Australian people.
Yeah, but in 83, John Howard got the coalition to go along with the float of the dollar. In spite of Anthony and Peacock's opposition, the coalition supported it.
Well, Doug Anthony didn't support it.
No, but he was the leader of the National Party. The coalition supported it.
Well,
and Howard spoke to Anthony about it.
Yeah, that's right. And we got a tip didn't off. Support it.
Yeah, but the coalition supported it. In opposition, they did.
Well, I think it's better to say they didn't oppose it. I mean, there's not. I know, but there's actually not any. There's actually nothing on the record from Andrew Peacock supporting the float of the dollar. And when I asked, when I interviewed Peacock, he said he didn't support the float of the dollar. But Howard, who was shadow treasurer, strongly supported it. And Malcolm Fraser, the former Liberal leader, didn't support the float of the dollar.
But if the coalition didn't oppose it, they supported it. That's what oppositions do. They oppose things. They didn't oppose it. Now, we can go to Rich. You've got to be very brief.
We don't have a lot of time. Very quick.
No, there it is. Okay. Don't be very brief, OK?
Keating, Hawke, Howard, Costello. Contrast.
I think it's a much closer relationship between Hawke and Keating. Keating, in the early years of the government, would go over to the lodge with his family for Sunday barbecues. Peter Costello was never invited to the lodge to have dinner with John Howard once. During his prime ministership. So it's a different relationship personally. Professionally, they both obviously worked, both teams obviously worked very well together and very effectively. The thing is, though, is that, you know, Peter Costello didn't launch the challenge that everyone thought he should have against John Howard. He's still bitter about that. I've interviewed Costello about it. He argues he never had the numbers, so he didn't do it. But Keating is the one with the courage. Keating's the one with the political bravery. And of course, he did launch that challenge against Hawke and lost the first one, but won the second one.
So there's a final question here, Anne. William, you've got to be brief.
Yes, okay. Well, my question is about his childhood and origins. I'm always puzzled by how this man could be the son of a man of the cloth, a preacher. Are we simply talking about rebellion? Or is he in some way his father's son, despite everything?
Look, it's a complex question because Hawke loved his parents deeply. And even when I did that last interview with Hawke, tears welled in his eyes as he recalled his mother and his father. They were the most important people in his life. He loved them. He missed them. His father was his best friend from his early age right through his entire life. But it's puzzling to me that for a guy who had such loving and supportive parents and knew how important that was for him, that he could not do it for his own children. Now, it's not to say he didn't love his children and his children didn't love him. They did, of course. But it is a puzzling question. I don't think it's so much of a rebellion because he didn't dislike his parents. He wasn't challenging them or rebelling them. He just went a different way and did different things. And of course, it was the drinking, which was the biggest issue for his mother, because she was a leader in the Christian temperance movement. That upset her no end. I don't think it's rebellion. I think it's just Hawke finding his own way. But it is extraordinary. And I'll just end with a sad note, which is that, you know, I asked Hawke if he could do it all again, surveying the wreckage to his children, his first marriage, all the hurt and upset that he did, would you do it a different way? And he said no, he wouldn't have.
Many thanks, Troy.
So as usual, I'll be very brief. So thanks, Troy, for a great presentation tonight. We've got copies of Troy Bramson, Bob Hawke, Demons and Destiny, and I'm sure you'll sign them tonight, and also copies online. Thanks to our people on Zoom. Thanks for those in the room. And this will be shown later on Sky News and be up on our website. But for tonight, well done. Thank you.
Thanks, Jerry. Okay.